My guest today is the legendary entertainer Tony Orlando, and he has achieved 15 top 40 hits, 2 platinum albums, 3 gold, and millions of copies sold. And he won 2 American Music Awards and a People's Choice Award for Best Male Entertainer. He is best known for his 5 number one hit records, Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree, Knock 3 Times, Candida, My Sweet Gypsy Rose, and He Don't Love You Like I Love You. But did you know that Tie a Yellow Ribbon was the number one Billboard song of the year for 1973 and went on to become the theme song for Tony Orlando and an anthem for hope, reunion, and renewal in America? He also has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame to commemorate his outstanding achievements in the entertainment industry, and outstanding they are. And Tony is finishing up his farewell tour, and to the delight of his countless fans, Tony will continue hosting his beloved hit radio show, Saturday Nights with Tony Orlando on 77 WABC Music Radio, which airs in New York and surrounding states. So ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, let's welcome one of the most legendary entertainers of the 20th and 21st century, the one and the only Tony Orlando, to the show. Welcome, Tony.
Boy, oh boy, doctor, I gotta tell you something, my friend. I think my wife or my daughter wrote that intro for you, because that was unbelievable. I didn't realize I did all that stuff, but thank you so much. And by the way, the radio show streams to 173 countries and goes across the nation, so, and out of New York City on that iconic radio station. But I don't mean to correct you, but I'm really proud of that, because the show is a big hit for us.
Well, I'm glad you told me that, because that means I can start tuning in every Saturday night to listen to you as well as your amazing guest. But I've got to ask, you've been performing for over 6 decades. Why stop now?
There comes a time when you just know when to stop. It's 64 years. I would have been happy with 64 weeks, 64 days. But 64 years, as you're approaching 80, you say to yourself, you know, it's time to pull away. And if you notice, Kenny Loggins has done it. Elton John has done it. Frankie Valli is doing it. Gladys Knight has done it. Bill Medley has done it. And all of us are from that same era, 60s, 70s, and early 80s. And so the basic reason for that are many. One, it's time. Two, the audiences are changing. Let's not fool ourselves. Three, the ability to even earn the income is difficult, because the overhead to take a 7-piece band on the road, their salaries, their per diems, workman's comp, airline travel, which is $9,000, $10,000 per flight. You're talking about, if it was a candy store, you'd have to start closing shop. And so you take all of those business acumens, as well as the natural aging process goes on and as the business change, I think it's important to recognize that. Now, I'm not retiring from show business. I'm retiring from touring, but I am going to continue to stay in the industry, exercise and flex my writing muscles, do, you know, some screenplays, write a Broadway show. I've always wanted to write a novel. I'm going to try at that. And it's not even important to me, honestly, whether they sell or get accepted or not. I just want the process of good energy coming out of good times.
You know, you bring something up. I would love to see a Broadway play based on Tony Orlando. Because I just recently talked to Mauricio Martinez, and to me, the Latin American community needs more people like you and Mauricio and people like Gloria Estefan, because I think it's being underserved in the entertainment industry.
Well, we do have a Broadway show, and it is finished. And I had the honor of writing all the music with Michael Omardian, who's a multi-Grammy winner, as you know. And Michael and I did, along with my brother, David, we accomplished some 15 songs in a Broadway show, plus the hits. What I didn't want to do, and I have nothing against what they call jukebox shows. My God, look at what's happened to Frankie's show. and Neil Diamond's show right now. It's a big hit. But I wanted to stay within the community of Broadway thinking, because those people really love the idea of writing new music to your story. It's important to the Broadway community. And I learned that when I did Barnum on Broadway. And I learned that working with Broadway actors and producers and directors, they have a pride in that. And although the jukebox shows have been huge successes, I want to mix them both. I want to have part jukebox and traditional Broadway music writing. So the show is done. The money is there. Now we have to search for a theater.
Oh, well, I can't wait to see that come about. Now, how old were you when you got discovered?
Well, I got my first hit record was I was 16 years old. My first hit was called Halfway to Paradise. It was written by a young 18-year-old girl named Carole King. My second hit record was written by a 19-year-old Barry Mann. Both of them wrote my first two hit records. We were all together. Barry, his wife Cynthia, Carole, her husband Jerry, myself. We were under the guise of a man named Don Kirshner, who was a young 26-year-old, young entrepreneurial guru in the music business, and gave us all our starts. So he had those four. He had Simon and Garfunkel, at that time were called Tom and Jerry. He had Neil Diamond. He had Barry. He had Bobby Darin. He had Connie Francis. It goes on and on and on, the list of people. Neil Sedaka, Howie Greenfield. All of us were in the same office, kids, hoping to do your show. Someday we'd make it, you know.
That is an iconic lineup. And the music from you and all of the ones you just mentioned, to me, it is still timeless, still collecting, let's say, online downloads from Spotify and iTunes. People just love the feel-good, well, ballads. I mean, they're never going to go away.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, those were great years for music. And they were beginning music. Don't forget, when Halfway to Paradise came out, I was 16. That was 1961. That's only 6 years after Heartbreak Hotel. So rock and roll was in its infancy, and it was beginning to make a very important change musically from the 50s into the 60s. And the people that were responsible for that were those four names, plus Burt Bacharach, Lieber and Stoller. These people started to go, like for instance, the first record, I think was 1960, that used violins, a symphony orchestra sound, timpanis, was the Drifters song called There Goes My Baby. After that, the record business changed. It became more produced, more symphonic. And that's why you had a Carole King born. That's why you got a Burt Bacharach born. It was a very important turning point in the music business. And I was very lucky to be part of that time.
You know, Carole King got her first publishing contract at the age of 19, I think, no, 17. And she started young like the rest of you did. But like you said.
And Halfway to Paradise was her first hit.
How about that?
Yeah.
Now that is some music history right there. And now for you, you had five monster number one hits. Of course, Tie a Yellow Ribbon, Knock Three Times, which I could play that song every single day. Candida, My Sweet Gypsy Rose, and of course, He Don't Love You Like I Love You. Do you have a particular favorite out of the top five?
No, I have five children, and none of which are my favorite. Those five are like little kids to me, no. Yeah, but I'll be honest with you, if I had to... if I had to pick my favorite of all of them, believe it or not, it would have been Candida because it was the first. And that's the only reason.
But well, that makes sense.
Like you, I love Knock Three Times. And, you know, Knock Three Times went number one country. Billy Crash Craddock recorded that, went number one country. And there's a great country version by both George Jones on Knock Three Times. I don't know if you've ever heard it.
And not, Dolly Parton. Not George's version, no. I'm gonna have to look that up.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
You know what, two of my favorites, besides this top five, was always What Are You Doing on Sunday? That's the song I kind of, when I play it, I always make sure my wife is around. And, you know, sometimes I'll play it, like even on a Sunday morning, you know, like, what are you doing on a Sunday? Do you want to go down to the park or you want to get out and go do something? But I also love Summer Sand. I just love that song.
Well, you know, you have a happy spirit. It's what, even before we went on the air, you could tell that you're a really wonderful spirit. And those songs have that feeling to them. They're lighthearted, good spirited songs. The girl who wrote Candida, by the way, Tony Wine, also wrote What Are You Doing Sunday? And the guy who wrote Yellow Ribbon also wrote Summer Sands.
Well, that...
So you're basically a fan of those writers, if you think about it. Because Irwin Levine and Larry Brown wrote Knock Three Times, which you love. And Tony Wine, who wrote Candida, also wrote What Are You Doing Sunday? So basically, your ear is hearing a kindness to those four writers.
Well, I was playing, for the past few days, I was playing a lot of your songs over and over again. Of course, I could do it on even on a regular day. And then, you know, once I got through the top five number ones, and then, of course, you know, What Are You Doing Sunday and Summer Sand, and listening to all of these songs, I'm just like, why can't people write like this anymore? Because these songs are so memorable. You want to sing along with them. You sing them with a smile on your face. And that's the type of music that we need. And for you, okay, so Candida was your first number one.
As Tony Orlando and Dawn, yes.
So how did you actually get discovered? And then when were you paired with Dawn? With the both of the ladies?
Well, from 1968 to 1971, I was vice president of CBS Music working with Clive Davis. And at that time, I thought that was going to be my career behind the desk. The British invasion came. My early hits were there, but then after that, there was no response to American performers. It was all Rolling Stones, Dave Clark Five, and they raised the bar for the industry, without a doubt. The Beatles did, and the Stones, without a doubt. You talk about writing, those two were the most prolific writers of all time. Something like 300 songs in their short lifetime. But to answer your question, I backed into the Tony Orlando and Dawn hit of Candida. I was served a request by a friend of mine who came to my office, Hank Medris, who you remember was part of a group called the Tokens, The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And he was part of that group. He was also a record producer. And he came to my office and he said, Tony, I'm broke. I need $3,000 to pay all of my bills or else I'm going to be evicted. Could you buy this master, this record that I produced? And he plays it for me, and it's called Candida. And it's the record that you and I have all heard and the one I put my voice on. So I said, this is a great song, man. I said, look, I'm not a record company. I'm a publisher. But I tell you what, this song is not right for Columbia Records because they're more album-oriented. Let me go to a label that really has a love for singles, like the Partridge Family, The Fifth Dimension. We're all on a label called Bell Records, which eventually became Arista Records. Took it to them, got a commitment for the $3,000, unless we did one thing. We had to change the lead voice on the record. So I go back and I tell this to Hank, and he goes, you do it. I said, I can't put my voice on here. I work for Columbia Records and Clive Davis. I can't be moonlighting like that. I'm a vice president here. He said, Tony, I'm broke. He said, didn't you used to do all the demos for Carole King when she wrote for the Drifters? I said, yeah. Didn't you have her first hit record with Halfway to Paradise? I said, yeah. Isn't this record similar to that time? I said, very much so. He said, do it, please. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll do it, but you can't call the record Tony Orlando. I don't care if you call this group on this record Joe Schmo and the Nail Biters. You do not use my name, period. So I go in, and here's how I cut our first hit record, okay? The Tony Orlando era. Here's how I go. Okay, Hank, what's the first line? Stars won't come out if they know that you're about. Wait a minute, let me hear that. Stars won't come out if they, I think I got it. Okay, play the track. He plays the track, I sing. Stars won't come out if they know that you're about. What's the next line? He sings, 'cause they couldn't match the glow of your eyes. Okay, I got it. We did that record one line at a time. Finished it in an hour. I went home, forgot I recorded it. 3 months later, it was number one in the country under the name Dawn. How did they come up with the name Dawn and not Joe Schmo and the Nail Biters? Very simple. He was very smart. He named it after the president's daughter. I figured he'd get some good attention, see? So it worked, and it went to number one, sold 2 million records, and I still didn't want anybody to know. We've seen one-hit wonders come and go. No. He comes back. Cut not three times. Your favorite one, Doctor, your favorite song. I say to him, are you ready? This could never be a hit. He goes, why not? I said, why? Because they don't have pipes exposed to bang on twice in the Midwest. Only in Brooklyn will this song be a hit, in those tenement buildings. And I cut it thinking it would not be a hit. 4 million records. Now you got 6 million records with two releases. It was time for me to leave Clive Davis and Columbia Records and go after my dream.
Wow. That is the that, most that incredible. The most and incredible. Here's what I love.
Here's what I love.
Is the way back in the day that people figured out a way to make a record and then not knowing that it's going to be the very record that puts them on the map. I mean, because here you are at the CBS Music Division working under Clive Davis. You were representing people like James Taylor, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Barry Manilow. I mean, the list goes on. Under the legendary Clive Davis, was that hard for you to leave?
No.
Not after 6 million records.
It was hard to leave Clive because he gave me my break. It was hard to leave him as a man, person, a friend. I had signed Barry Manilow and got his record. And by the way, when I signed Barry, I took him to the same record company I took that record of Candida to, Bell Records. I took him, which became Arista, which became his label. But yes, I was representing these people, signing Barry, had a great 4-year run with Clive. I went to Clive and I said, I'm going to have to leave you. And he looked at me and he went, why? Because you're Dawn? And I said, wait a minute. You knew this? He goes, Tony, it's the worst kept secret in the record business. Everybody knows that's you. They do? Yeah. He said, tell you what, you go after your dream. If you don't make it, you can always come home. I never forgot that. And just recently, a 90-year-old Clive Davis, just this year, inducted me into the New Jersey Hall of Fame, along with Dionne Warwick, my sweet sister. So there, all these years later, what goes, all that went down, and everything that's happened, I go into the New Jersey Hall of Fame right there with Whitney Houston and Frank Sinatra and Frankie Valli and Bruce Springsteen. And who brings me on? Clive Davis.
He is legendary. He is legendary. And we have to talk about Tie a Yellow Ribbon. That song was number one on Billboard in 1973. But that was the song that reunited America. I still remember to the day when we were all tying yellow ribbons around our trees in the front yard. What did that mean to you when this phenomenon was happening across America?
Well, I got a taste of it right away, because the first time I ever sang the song was to welcome home our POWs in Vietnam. It was with Bob Hope at the Cotton Bowl. It was 1973. 70,000 people were there. And Bob Hope invited us to come sing, and the song was only out a month. And I saw these 500 incredibly tortured, brave homecoming veterans being welcomed by these 70,000 people singing Tie Yellow Ribbon. And Bob Hope looked at me and winked at me after the show, and he said, "You know, Tony, you're going to be singing this song for the rest of your life." He said, "Because that opening line is every parent's dream come true for their military sons or daughters. I'm coming home. I've done my time." And from now on, and he was right, because when the Iranian hostage crisis happened, for 444 days, news anchor famous Walter Cronkite had behind him a screen with an American flag on it and a yellow ribbon, because the wife of Bruce Langdon, who was the administrator of our place there in Iran, our embassy, American embassy, he was in charge. He was held captive. While he was held captive, she tied a yellow ribbon around an oak tree. And that started the trend for America, because for 444 days, everybody started following suit, like you said. And also, Mr. Bond, the space shuttle went up with a yellow ribbon on it. The Astrodome had a yellow ribbon pulled around it. And New York City literally did a ribbon around the entire city, people carrying it and linking together. That's how amazing this phenomenon happened. Now, you asked, how did I feel? I was in disbelief that a record that I went in on a rainy day in the afternoon had such impact on our country. And it continues to do so. After that, Desert Storm. The logo for Desert Storm in that 100-day war, if there's such a thing as a logo for a war, was the yellow ribbon, because it brought those troops home in parades. Then, again, in Iraq, it became a signature for the military. When I went there in 2008 to perform for them, they were tied on every Jeep and every tank in Iraq. Then, as we go on, I go to the Philippines, and I find out that in the Philippines, it's the theme song for the president there, because she was welcomed home with yellow ribbons after her husband was killed by terrorists on a tarmac. Then I find out that in Hong Kong, right now as you and I speak, the yellow ribbon is used as a symbol of democracy, as they fight for their democracy in Hong Kong, and they play that record that I recorded at every event. Then I find out that it's in 14 for different reasons, but mostly returning prisoners or people who are held captive. Now, to make my answer even longer to your question, how would you feel? I repeat the question to you. When you find out that recently in Israel, for instance, there's a yellow ribbon on every pole, every car, every building, every lapel, to hope for those hostages, both Israeli and American, to come home. I repeat, how would you feel? You'd be in a state of shock. You'd be in a state of like, how is it possible that I was part of such an event that has done so much good for the world?
Oh, I would be in complete awe, and it would be an incredible honor.
Oh, definitely. And Irwin Levine and Larry Brown wrote the song. Again, I was just the mailman that delivered the letter.
Well, how did the variety show come about?
The variety show is interesting. No one has ever asked me that question. You're the first, really. We had the same manager as a group called the Fifth Dimension. His name was Mark Gordon. And he was married to Florence LaRue Gordon, one of the members of the Fifth Dimension. So we, Tony Orlando and Dawn, were managed by that man. So he books them as the headliners, no, as an opening act for Sonny and Cher at the Westbury Music Theater in New York. They had Up and Away, they were a big hit, but they were Sonny and Cher's opening act. Sonny and Cher, huge at the time. Well, Sonny gets sick. Cher won't go on without Sonny at the time. Mark says, okay, let's put the Fifth Dimension in the headliner spot and let's put this new group, Tony Orlando and Dawn, to open for the Fifth Dimension. So this was a movie, this was a theater in the round. That particular night, the president of CBS Television came to see Sonny and Cher, which were his acts, not knowing that they were not coming. He sits in the audience and he watches an opening act called Tony Orlando and Dawn. Now, variety was no longer on television at that point in time. Only Carol Burnett, all the other variety shows had ended. In fact, people were saying it would never happen again. Variety shows were dead. Mr. Silverman comes to me after the show and he says, Tony, how would you like to have a summer variety show? He said, I'm going to have Bobby Gentry and the Hudson Brothers, her in the beginning, June, you in the middle, and them at the end of the summer. Whoever gets the highest ratings is going to get an every week television show. So we went on, we did the show. We got 36 million people watching us that summer. We won. We got the variety show. We went on in January, and that's how it happened.
I still love that show. I mean, is there an episode that actually sticks out in your mind still today?
Oh, there's so many. So many. The one that, two that stick out of my mind, both with women. One was Phyllis Diller and Jen, we get a little information. One was Phyllis Diller. Forgive me, something's happened to the Zoom call here. We'll fix that in a minute. Everybody stay tuned. We don't want to lose my man. Mr. Ward, are you there?
Yeah, we're still here.
We lost. Now we got you back. Okay.
Yeah, we're
My
good.
apologies to you and your
All good.
audience. So, where was I?
Oh, about it was Tony Orlando and Dawn that became the weekly variety show after that summer.
So
Oh,
then
you had Phyllis Dillard, and there was someone else that you absolutely loved.
So she comes out, and on the show, I would have a little alcove where they would take a bow when I would introduce them. And I had this love for Phyllis. She was amazing. She was just the nicest lady in the world. So I go over and I take her in my arms and I bend her backwards and I kiss her on camera after, as I introduced her. I did it for the fun of it. Now, when I came up, her wig got caught on my cufflink and came off her head on camera, which meant that Phyllis Diller was a bald Phyllis Diller at that point. Well, the audience was hysterical, screaming, and Phil and I was embarrassed, walking away laughing, but embarrassed like you can't believe. I come back and I say to her, I promise we'll cut this out. She goes with her great laugh, ha ha, you better not. That's the biggest laugh I'll ever get. To show you how great she was, she allowed us to air that. And right now on YouTube, that scene is there with I don't know how many millions of people have tuned in to watch that, but that's one of the moments I remember. The other moment I remember is working with Ruth Buzzi, another incredible comedian. Ruth Buzzi did a sketch with me where she played a fan of mine. We ad-libbed it. There was no dialogue. So everything this woman did, she did in her mind what an overenthusiastic fan would be doing. She literally tears me apart in this butcher shop. And then finally her husband, Danny Thomas, comes out with a butcher knife to take care of me. This Italian butcher, you know, hey, I'm going to knock you out. I'm going to cut your head off, you know. And that moment got one of the biggest, longest laughs I ever received on that show. But there are many. The time I was on with Jerry Lewis, and I became friends with Jerry Lewis and hosted his telethon for 33 years after that. So there are many moments, many, many moments. I mean, I couldn't count them over a four-year period.
Well, you know, only the three variety shows that I remember, and the reason why they were so successful is because of the humor. Of course, Sonny and Cher had great writers. There was a lot of banter. And the same way with Tony, Orlando, and Dawn. And you had two women to deal with when it came to any type of comedy. The other one that was magical as a variety show was Mac Davis.
Oh, yeah. And he was a magical man. He was a magical person. Let me tell you about Mac Davis. Mac Davis was one of the nicest, most creative songwriters, great entertainer, but a good human being that you'd ever want to meet in a lifetime. He was really something. If it wasn't for Sonny and Cher, there would have been no Tony Orlando and Dawn. We were just copying them.
Yeah, but there was just something about all three of you together. It was magic.
Well, there was three of us, but here's what we did. I remember Freddie Silverman saying, boy, that Thelma Hopkins, she's sure alive, and she's quick with the tongue, boy. But that Joyce, she's awfully quiet. How are we going to write the humor? I said, well, it's very simple, Freddie. I said, we have a devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other. And that was the context or subtext of the comedy writing.
And I can see that clear as day. And I knew that one day when if I ever got the chance to interview you, I was going to have to ask you this question because I still see the photo today. What did Freddie Prinze mean to you, one of the world's greatest comedians?
It's just what's incredible. You just called him one of the world's greatest comedians. He was only in show business for 2 years. That's how great he was. That he is stuck to your ribs, your laughter ribs, all these years later, and he was only in the business for 2 years. He was a comedic genius. I remember doing the Tonight Show with him when he was hosting it. This is a 22-year-old kid hosting Johnny Carson's chair in the Tonight Show. That was a miraculous day. His first guest was me because we were best friends. And I remember, his first guest was Bob Hope, because the first guest on the Tonight Show was the bigger star. Why is that instead of the closer? Because people went to sleep by the time 11:30, you know, by the time the show was over. So the early audience was the biggest audience. So Bob passes me, Bob Hope, and he said, who is this kid out there? I said, Bob, his name is Freddie Prinze. He goes, I may be the king of comedy, but he's going to be the prince of comedy. No, he's a genius. He's going to fill my shoes. That came from Bob Hope's mouth, who at the time was king of the hill, was the pope of comedy, was the king of comedy, right? And for him to say that, because Hope didn't throw out compliments that quickly. I got to know Bob very well. And he was very careful because he never wanted to sound like his compliments were meaningless. You know, sometimes people are good-natured. They compliment all the time. So their compliments lose power. He was the kind of guy who felt if he didn't compliment everybody and did it once in a while, people would recognize that he meant it. So 2 years, greatness, great actor, dies self-inflictedly, was the biggest, most horrific blow-up, disappointment, frightening time of my life. I never saw anybody die before, and the last pair of lips that kissed his lips were mine. So the truth of the matter is, I loved this kid. He was 10 years younger than me. He was like a young brother. And he was a great loss to the world of comedy and entertainment.
When I used to watch Chico and the Man, and it was the only real true comedy sitcom where I would laugh out loud. Yeah. Because Freddie's timing was so impeccable. But he came across as if he ad-libbed all his lines, because you would have never known that some writer was back there writing them. His delivery was genius. I can't even, sometimes I sit and think, how high would his star would have gone if he was still alive today? Oh my gosh. He would be the king of comedy.
Oh yeah. He would have been. Absolutely. You know, when he did my variety show, we wrote a sketch with the writers called Road to Puerto Rico. And what we would do is we were emulating the Bing Crosby. They were called road movies. So it was the comedian and the singer, the road to Morocco, the road to Hong Kong, the road. That was a whole lineup of series of movies from Hope and Crosby. Bob Hope and Bing Crosby had us ready to do those comedies again with Road to Puerto Rico, which was a sketch we did on my TV show. And working with him as an actor, your point about his timing, his stand-up was impeccable, but you want to stand by him in an acting scene. It was ridiculous, because not only was his timing unbelievable, he would ad-lib and rewrite the sketch and make it funnier on his feet. Oh no, he was something else. He was on another planet, man.
Really, you know, something. I always wondered, Tony, what would have happened if we were ever blessed on this planet back in the day to ever see Freddie Prinze and Robin Williams together. I don't think the room could handle that much energy.
And you know what's interesting about that combination? If I had to put a combination together that would have been as big as Lewis, Martin and Lewis, that if that was a comedy team, they would have repeated that success. Can you imagine them as a team?
They were both kings of ad-libbing.
Oh, yes. Ad-libbing.
I mean, think about this. Time. Well, go ahead, Tony. Go ahead.
Pardon me?
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh, no, I was going to say, the director of the movie Mrs. Doubtfire with Robin Williams, he stated a few months ago, he still has 200 million feet of film of outtakes and retakes with Robin Williams just on that film alone, because Robin just goes off script so fast.
You know who doesn't get enough credit for being that kind of a guy? Is the man who did The Grinch.
Jim Carrey.
Yeah. When you watch that movie, it passes the line of brilliance. It's in another world. It's comedically, he's ad-libbing most of those scenes. And that's his genius as well. And Robin was a big fan of his. And you could see why. But if you watch that movie now and watch his characterization of the Grinch, it's deserving of a special Academy Award, in my opinion. Comedy doesn't get the Academy Awards, usually. An example, Adam Sandler, on many occasions, and his dramatic performances, deserved an Academy Award. But because he's a comedian, he never gets that slot. Jerry never got that slot. And I think that Robin deserved it, never got it. I think because
they both did. I mean, both Jim Carrey and Robin Williams had dramatic roles. Right. And I think there's a genius there with comedians that when they do something in the field of drama, we need to pay much closer attention because they have extra skills that other actors don't have.
So true. And most comedians have a dark side. They don't want to admit it. Some do. Some have admitted it to me. But that dark side is dealt with by being funny. That moment of being depressed, or that moment of being sad or feeling lonely, the way they get out of it is by going to God's greatest medicine, which is laughter.
It is. Well, let me ask you this, Tony, because you have performed for 6 decades. What are you going to miss the most about performing?
People, the audiences. Performing, I don't have the fire in my belly anymore to do that. The fire in my belly is to be creative and to write shows and create shows, find new talent, produce them. That's where my fire is. But what I miss the most is the people, the audiences, the look on their faces, that look that goes something like this for 2 hours. The laughter, the sound of their laughter, the meet and greets after, the stories they share with me, the times the times that a guy can say to me, you know, I have 4-stage cancer, and this is the greatest moment of my life, this show. What? And he comes back 4 years later and says, I'm free of cancer, and it's still the greatest moment of my life, this show. Moments like that, and I remember that guy like yesterday, made me go out and make sure that every show I did, I said to myself, person out there who might be facing that kind of future, I better make this the best show he ever saw. Well, I really appreciate your questions.
You're very welcome.
Can we do this more often?
You want to do this again?
I would love to do this again.
Well, let me get with Scott or Jeremy, and we'll set up a time. Go ahead.
You tell Scott if he doesn't get this one together, he's in big trouble.
I will tell him, because Scott and I are very good friends, but I will tell you this. You kick off one of my most iconic interview weeks. I just finished up about 40, 50 pre-Oscar interviews. But this week, I've got, not only do I have you, I've got legendary, of course, Dan Hill. I've got Billy Baldwin. I've got Crystal Gayle. And I had John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, but we moved him to Monday. So it's just been, an incredible week that you kicked off for me. And not only that, Dan Hill's already connected here with us.
Hey, Dan. And,
let me do something real quick. I'm gonna try to pull off something really incredible here. And hold on 1 second.
Jeremy has booked us another one, so I got to be careful.
Hold on, I've got to find the right. Here we go. Here we go. Number. Let me see if I can't pull this off during the recording here. Oh, and Tony, here is Dan Hill.
Great to meet you, Tony. I'm a huge fan.
Hey, you know, after all these years, I was telling Ward about Barry Mann's first hit record was a song I cut called "Bless You," 1961. And I put him and Cynthia together. I don't know if you know that.
But, no, I did not know that. That's incredible.
Yeah, we started together. So I remember when he cut the demo and played and sang for me, Sometimes When We Touch. And I can tell you, I think it's one of the greatest songs ever written of all time. Thank you for that.
That means so much.
An amazing performance that you gave.
Thank you. Thank you. It means a lot.
Now, I'm going to leave you with this guy. He's crazy, by the way. Watch out. Ward Bond, watch out for him. He's a little crazy.
Well, Tony, you can't leave just at this moment, because I always do a closing with my guests. But you know what? We're going to do the closing this time with not only, of course, you, but we're going to keep Dan on screen here, because this is an iconic moment for me, but also for the world of music and entertainment, to have both of you here at the same time. And ladies and gentlemen, you can't get any better than having Tony Orlando here, who is on his farewell tour, but also the incredible one, the Canadian in the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame, the one and only Dan Hill, known for Sometimes When We Touch, one of the top 100 most played songs on the planet by BMI. So this is an iconic moment. So again, ladies and gentlemen, Tony Orlando, he is a national institution. His songs continue to put smiles on every single face, bringing back memories. And if for some reason you've been living under a rock and you have not heard his songs, you need to take a listen, because you'll be singing along and your body will be swaying back and forth to his music. So hey, knock three times, head over to TonyOrlando.com and tie a yellow ribbon around it. And of course, take a listen on iTunes or Spotify. And Tony, you are the man, and I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for putting me next to a genius. And that man that you have on your show right there fills that slot. Believe me, not only as a songwriter, but an amazing musician singer. He is one of the greats right there. Dan Hill, I'm humbled to be on the same screen with you.
Absolute privilege to meet you, Tony. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Tony Orlando, and a special appearance within this interview, the one and only Dan Hill. And I want to thank all of you for watching and listening today. And as for me, hey, I'll see you next time.